oven is dirty.
What? Oven?
Let me take the opportunity to welcome each and every one of you here. But before we do that, formally, can I request that we invite the Almighty in whatever way we do it by observing a silence of meditation and prayer? Can we? Thank you very much. Let me welcome each and every one of you here, in particular the committee whip, Honorable Mamburu Afza along with me. We want to thank God for being with her. We've been with you in prayers, and we are glad that today you are back in the committee. And also welcome each and every one of your members, officials, delegation from Department of Home Affairs, our little advisor from Parliament, and everyone who is in the midst after a long break of election. It was a very exciting period where we saw in our country democracy maturing. Democracy in action. We really appreciate our constitution because as a country we have matured. And also congratulate the IEC in their ascension. IEC, there are so many I's. IEC for good, I must say. There are so many speculations before the election that this will happen, that will happen, because now there is this one, elections will go this direction. But fortunately, as a country, as a people, we have matured in democracy. We had good elections. We want to congratulate all parties for their participation in elections. Know that we are happy with everything, but it was God to congratulate them. It was free and fair elections. We want to appreciate that. The effort that we have put, it has to come to the good interest of our people. Having said that, honorable members, we have only two items that you're going to consider today. I'm hoping that we're going to have a short meeting because both items came before the committee. We're just here to analyze them. The first item is on the... Yeah, I did not deal with apologies. I have... The two apologies from my side is an apology from Honorable Stock, who is on sick leave, and the second one is from Pavos Bokwana. We're not expecting the MEC, the minister or the deputy minister, because the bill that we're dealing with is Parliament bill. As a result, we have our legal advisor, but also a legal advisor from the Department of Home Affairs. We are both here, invited them if they have some issues to deal with. I'm not going to open for any other apologies because we're supposed to get them in writing. Honorable Mambo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. My appreciation for being with me during my hard times. Yes, I'm back in action now. I just wanted to confirm the apology of Honorable Stoko. He has also called me to say I submit that apology.
Thank you very much, Committee Whip. The first item, deliberation and finalization of the Immigration Amendment Bill. Members will remember that we got the presentation or a briefing on the bill. What we had to do as a committee to finalize it is to do a public participation. And I am hoping that we have received the brief, that we have received some submissions, which I will give this opportunity now to the Parliament legal advisor to take us through the submissions. Thereafter, I will invite the Department of Home Affairs to make some inputs. Then I will open for members to deliberate on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Good morning, all honourable members. As the Chairperson has advised, a briefing on this bill was given to this committee on the 25th of May. Subsequent to that, the bill was advertised for public comment with a closing date of the 8th of August. Two submissions were received on the 8th of August, as there had also been a public participation process in the portfolio committee. The two submissions were one of which was received from an individual, Mr. Happy Makumi, and the second one was received by Business Unity South Africa, known as BUSA. Now, the researcher of this committee has prepared a summary of the submission, so I'm just going to highlight those very key salient points that have taken out of the summary, out of the submission. But the submission is thank you. The first mission from Mr. Makumi, he highlights that foreign nationals whom South Africa deems in countries not safe for return should be exempted from such penalties. Now, the penalty he is referring to is what the bill provides for, which is a disqualification from entering South Africa when a person has overstayed their visa for no valid reason. I'm not going to, the department will respond to each of these, so I'm just going to highlight the point. He also says that foreign nationals entering South Africa should be vetted in the countries of the region to avoid criminals coming to South Africa. He also makes a point that the committee should look into setting a target for the number of foreign nationals admitted into South Africa at any given time. And finally, he suggests that foreign nationals who are contributing positively in the development and economic growth of South Africa, who have genuine reasons for overstaying, should not be treated as those who pose a threat or challenge to South Africa. Those are his key 4 points, and from my perspective, I think the bill can address his concerns. The second submission from BUSA raised concerns related to foreign nationals who are mainly employed in the mining and agricultural sector, and those that overstay due to circumstances such as hospitalization or serious medical conditions. Their main concern is that when a person is injured or in hospital for a lengthy time, the prolonged stay can lead to the temporary permits becoming expired. And then while they are in hospital, they will be considered, or the penalties that are created in this bill will apply to them. So they would want for that kind of situation to be accommodated. They also say that the amendments seek to disqualify foreigners who overstay from entering the country in future and from obtaining the necessary permits to enable them to be admitted into the country. Their concern is that if these amendments are effective, it will result in these workers not being able to return to their employment in South Africa after their recovery from the injuries or diseases that occasion their hospitalization. From my perspective, I also think the Act and the Bill would cater for situations like this. Finally, they say that the process to apply for the status and for authorization to remain in South Africa after foreign nationals have become illegal foreigners is a very lengthy process and requires foreign nationals to prove exceptional circumstances. BUSA states that there is no upfront guarantee that the prolonged hospital stay will be regarded as exceptional circumstances. So in relation to the concerns above, they make the following propositions. They firstly propose that a list of circumstances that will be regarded as exceptional for purposes of the proposed new Section 32 be expanded on and published as part of the amendment. They also propose that the list should include circumstances in which foreign nationals are unable to leave the borders of South Africa or to apply for an extension of the period of the stay or to renew their papers due to no fault of their own, such as hospitalization or serious medical conditions. They propose that a framework be developed for foreign nationals who are hospitalized for long periods due to injuries or diseases for them to be assisted to renew their permits before expiry while they are still in hospital. They also propose that a mechanism should be developed by which affected persons can apply for condemnation should they be prevented from renewing their permits. It is first suggested that the distinction be made between listed grounds, such as hospitalization, and unlisted grounds that would warrant condemnation and a stay in their deportation. And I think that concludes the two submissions that we received.
What is your take on that? Before I give one.
Firstly, Madam Chair, can just look at the provision of the bill. What the bill seeks to do is to disqualify those people or foreign nationals who overstay a visa in our country. In other words, we're not given a visa. They are given a visa to stay in our country for a certain period of time. If that visa, if they overstay the visa and they have no valid reason, what would be happening in practice is that when they leave the country, they will automatically be disqualified from coming into our country again for a certain period of time. Now, that period of time will be set in regulations. Because if they would have been, because the idea of the department is that if they would have been overstayed in our country, say, for 5 days because they were enjoying the beaches and they just didn't take the time to renew the visa. But if they're a first offender, then possibility exists that when they leave the country, they'll be disqualified from coming into our country, say, for the next 3 months. If they overstay for 30 days, the department might apply a long period. So when that period lapses, that period of disqualification lapses, and they then apply for the visa, they're able to get the visa. If, however, they become repeat offenders, in terms of the other section in the Act, which is the principle at Section 30, they could be declared as being undesirable. But say, for example, somebody stays in our country, but they have a very valid reason. So on the way to the airport, they have every intention of leaving, but they're involved in an accident, and they land in an involving hospital. There is provision in the Act that says, even when you're in hospital, you should have regularized your stay here. What that means applies to the extension, because now circumstances have led that you couldn't leave the country on the date that you were supposed to because of the unforeseen circumstance. You should have regularized your stay. But if you haven't regularized your stay and you do leave the country, you will be disqualified, but there's a second section in our bill that will allow them to make an application to the DG to waive that disqualification because they would have had a valid reason for overstaying. So now if you look at the concerns by Booster, all of that is accommodated for. For example, if their workers are hospitalized or they do have a disease and for some reason they couldn't regularize their stay and they do leave, they will be disqualified. But what will happen is that they can apply to have that disqualification waived because they would have had a valid reason. And that could have been an exceptional circumstance, which will be set out in the regulations. Now, Booster says you must put those circumstances in the Act. But the idea of putting it into the Act will make it a little bit harder to amend. So when things are in regulations, they are easier to amend, and those regulations will be made by the Minister, who is best placed to determine what those circumstances would be where he would want to waive the disqualification. The other issue raised by Mr. Happy, which says that, foreign nationals whom the country South Africa deems the country not safe for the return, should immediately be exempt from a penalty like this. Now, those foreigners have another remedy. If they cannot go back to their countries, they can stay there but apply for asylum. I think the whole purpose of all these provisions is to make sure that any foreign national who is in our country is documented and is here legally under the correct visas and under the correct authority. But where they don't have that, our bill will disqualify them. The bill before us now will disqualify them, but it doesn't leave them without a remedy if they do have a valid reason. So I do think those concerns are catered for. Mr. Happy was saying that foreign nationals should be vetted from their countries of origin before a visa is granted. Now, the department can correct me here, but before any visa is granted, there are lots of documents that are requested. So if somebody, if obviously you won't be getting a visa if you're a fugitive from justice, because the Act provides for things like that. for example, Section 50 does allow the DG to declare somebody undesirable. If they have committed a crime in another country and they're fugitive from justice, in that instance, they won't be allowed to come into our country. So I do think most of the concerns raised in both submissions are catered for in the Act as well as in the bill.
Thank you very much, Home Office.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Select Committee. My name is Jackson McKay. I'm the Deputy Director General responsible for Immigration Services, and I am assisted today by members of our legal department, Mr. Sevela Matla, as well as Ms. Adams, to respond to the issues that were raised. Honourable Chairperson and members, the response given by the parliamentary legal advisor is a similar kind of response that the department will give, because we had a look at the issues and she's spot on in these particular issues. The issues raised by Mr. Mokumi is clear in terms of foreign nationals that, and not most foreign nationals that can't return to their home country, apply for asylum in South Africa. And it's a complete different regime that deals with them. It is, they are then catered for under the Refugees Act. And the Refugees Act offers them protection in South Africa. And also the principle of non-refoulement does not permit a country to return someone to his home country if he's at the risk of persecution or death or whatever when he returns to such country. So that is being dealt with. With regard to the vetting issue as well, that is why we have requirements for a visa. You can only come to South Africa if you satisfy certain requirements. And by giving those requirements, we are able to vet you to see if you would be a threat to our national security. Secondly, would you be able to sustain yourself whilst you are in the country? And basically, those are the issues, or the vetting issues that's done for every applicant for a applies for a visa in South Africa. Then he raises issues of setting targets for foreign nationals coming into South Africa. Now, those are more policy matters, not really related to the amendment that we are doing now. As the Honourable Chair and Honourable Members know, that we are in the process of reviewing our immigration, whole immigration policy. So I am sure Mr. Mokumi will have another bite there to input on the policy matters in terms of quotas and things that I think that he's suggesting here during that particular process to see if it would be viable. Chairperson, with regard to the issue of BUSA, really the Act allows for that. People can apply to extend the visas while they are in South Africa. And in this category of employees that's referred to by BUSA are mostly those that are employed under what we call a corporate visa. Now, in the past, the corporate visa, those are for mine workers as well as those that are employed in the agricultural sector. In the past, they had to renew their corporate permits yearly. But now it is being issued for a period of 3 years. So we don't expect currently under this the new or the amended regulations that we would have people overstaying, because if they are hospitalized, it should be within that period. And if they are hospitalized, let's say, coming near the end of that period, they can then apply to the Director General to have the overstay waived. And like we're dealing with it now, if people apply for it, we uplift the undeniability in most of these cases. We also think that is why there is no need for condemnation as is requested by BUSA, because they are able to apply to the Director General. And in terms of it becoming part of the Act, we are in agreement with the advisor, is that these things change, circumstances change. So when that change takes place, we would need to be able to quickly deal with that if new exceptional circumstances arise. And if it is in the Act, it would mean that we have to come back to Parliament every time and have an amendment to the Act. So it's much easier to have it in the in the regulations. Chairperson, I think that would be our response to it, and we would concur with the advisor.
We know almost we depend on you, all of you this time. We don't want to make mistakes. Don't want to give an opportunity again. Is there anything that you want to add from the legal side? I'm serious about this. We don't want to pass this bill later. If you say it is unconstitutional, then this means that we depend on you on this thing. That's why I'm giving you more time to speak on it. Anything you want to add from the legal section? Home Affairs?
No, thanks, Chairperson and honorable members of us. The FDG indicated maybe just one other element of vetting that I might add that will make us be at ease is that we now require people to appear in person and when making the application so that we are able to relate to who is the applicant, unlike previously when someone was just sent through the passport and later on when there are challenges with the permit or visas which change the passport, then the person will simply say, but I applied through an agent, and therefore not giving us an opportunity to be able to check is the person who the visa issued for the actual person also. So we're dealing with those type of issues. And just to re-emphasize more on the corporate visas as well. And the process also has been done in such a way that previously it used to be issued for 12 months. And every 12 months, the expiry of 12 months, most minors, for example, would have to go back home and attend to their own issues and then come back and reapply again. So we've done away with that. If the employer comes to us and says, I want a corporate visa for 100 people for 3 years, we give them maximum 3 years so that the movement in between is free. They don't have to go to the borders, have to be checked, the documents and the like. They just move free like any other person. And also, the applications are done outside of the country to apply for that certificate first time, no longer at the port of entry. So we've tried to ease much more of the arrangements that we have. And in the case of hospitalization, if you're hospitalized, if you've got a 3 year visa, you don't have to be worried about extensions and life, unless otherwise, as DDG indicated, it's part that is closer to the end of the visa. And as well, there is the same section 31 says, if you are declared undesirable, that is only if you have left the country. But if you are still within the country and you are in hospital, you can start the process to apply. To be given, we call the Form 20 mostly the best so that people recognize it. It allows you to be authorized to make an application even if you are illegal at that moment. So the DG will then say, if you are ready to make an application, you've got all documentation that you need to apply either for a new visa or whichever one if you are pending, you can apply while it's still illegal. And then that time, in that time period, then you give your Form 20 that you can travel with around to the country. And it secures your free movement in terms of, you know, being accosted by the police or immigration officers that can produce, then they recognize you are awaiting the outcome of an application where you are applying to have a new status. So we really feel that the Act generally caters for most of their concerns raised, except the policy issues that we are still consulting for the green paper that we can also take on board in order to engage with the society in terms of maybe the team of the target and the methods that we might use with the new police to strengthen what has been raised as things that we might need to look at. So we agree with the parliamentary advisor's response as well that we are well catered for in terms of the consent rate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, deliberations on the submission, because we did look at the, I think we have to look as to the submission responses from our legal advisor as well as Congress, and what is our take as members. Anyone want to speak on this bill before we vote?
Thank you, honorable chairperson, colleagues, and the department. I am on the concerns by Business Unity South Africa. I'm not sure, Chairperson, that I'm convinced that their concerns have been properly ironed out. Because I think their concerns are that if a person is hospitalized and to the extent that he overstays, they say here that it then becomes a lengthy process to reapply. You become an unwanted person and it becomes a lengthy process thereafter. What I want to find out is there no way that, because of course there will always be circumstances beyond an individual's control, like the one they are fighting here. Is there no way that that can be accommodated by law, so that circumstances beyond my control do not warrant me unwanted, whereas it is not circumstances that I had control to, but it's circumstances that beyond anyone's control, so that you don't have to be subjected to that lengthy process of reapplying for a waiver. Already are unwanted, now you have to reapply for a waiver of the being unwanted status to the other status. I think that is their concern, and I'm not sure that I've had it being ironed out properly. Just want to get clarity on that one. Thank you.
It's an important question. I'm sure you got what he's saying. I'm not saying this one, just keep it in mind. If I understand him, what he's saying, with his corporate visa now, because if the person is sick, at least somebody who can speak on his behalf, on behalf of the person. Unlike if I'm involved in an accident or I get sick, nobody will go to Home Affairs and say, I'm sick, before I'm declared undesirable. Because now you have a corporate visa of 100 people, 10 of them get sick. What is it that you can do? Not for them to be declared as undesirable, because the business person or the mind can tell Home Affairs. I think that is how I understood your question. Okay, Honorable Zwane. Thank you for the briefing. I think the person raised a critical issue earlier on that relates to whether or not the amendments that were making are constitutional compliant, because it is always embarrassing for us as parliamentarians to pass laws that are finally questioned by the Constitutional Court as not being compliant. I hope you really and made absolutely certain that we are not going to be hit by this embarrassment. The one issue that I wanted to raise is the issue of this vetting that is done at the country of origin, and it is communicated through to South Africa Institute. What systems are there to ensure that the kind of information that you get from the country of origin is true? How do you authenticate the information? I'm asking this question, Mr. President, because we need to have a safety net where people should escape, because the kind of information that we're getting as a country is not true. So how do you verify? Thank you.
Was your hand up?
No, it wasn't.
Okay. Can we respond? I have one question. My question is on the corporate visa again. Is that you are saying in the past the visa application will be done in a time through agencies, but now people come in person. What happens in a corporate visa? I've got a mine, I applied for a corporate visa of 100 minors. Do they also come in person? Or you deal direct with the mining company or whoever is applying for that bill. Okay, those are the questions. Can I give you to respond?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, with regard to Honorable Kaula's submission, let's take just an example, if I could use an example. You have a worker that's either in the mine or working on a farm that's in an accident, he is ill. At any given time, his visa should still be valid, or the visa is valid for 3 years. Now, let us say that the accident happens near the end of the period of that visa and the person is hospitalized, the farmer or the employer would approach Home Affairs saying that this is a person who's been involved in an accident, his visa is about to expire, because the law is also clear that you need to renew your visa or extend it 6 months before expiry. So they would come to Home Affairs and say, this person is in hospital, he'll be in hospital for a longer period. Most of the time the doctor also give a letter informing Home Affairs the period of hospitalization or that the person is going to be in the country for a longer period. They would then apply to the Director General that they are able now to extend that visa in the country once this person is in hospital. In most cases, the Director General, that would be exceptional circumstances, the Director General would extend that period of the person. So he is not at risk of him being in the country illegally because he would have been able to extend his particular visa. So let us say now it happens on the last day that he has his visa expires. Let's hope, God forbid, it doesn't happen. But on that very last day when it happens, he is in hospital. He is hospitalized. They can again approach the Department of Home Affairs and apply for a medical visa. A medical visa is issued for 6 months for the period that a person would be in hospital. So there's always a recourse for people that are in the country in exceptional circumstances, because this would be exceptional circumstances. It would not be someone that is willfully overstaying. And the law and act cater for that. So it would cover them in any of those particular circumstances. Honorable Chairperson, the issue that you raised with regards to the corporate visa. Now, the corporate visa is a visa that enables economic development, our economic development. So it is granted to the farmers or to the mines to employ a number of people that they either need seasonally to come and work on their farm or for a particular period of time, or in the mines case of the mines, a number of people from our foreigners to work in the mines. So these visas are issued, and the certificates are issued by the farmer, or it's issued by the mine company itself. So what happens is, with the cooperation between our labor department and our DTI, TIEBA, our neighboring countries, and the agreement that they would have, they would source these workers from foreign countries, and they would say, we would need 300 people. The Department of Home Affairs would issue a corporate permit for that amount of people. Of course, that would have been cleared by the Department of Labor saying indeed they need 300 people during this particular period of time. And they are then sourced, when they source these workers, they are then able to issue them with the certificates. These workers are for us a lower risk worker, a foreigner coming into the country or traveling into the country, then the person that applies as a foreign mission service coming here as a tourist, only going to visit for a particular period of time, he doesn't need to give us much. He's not under the control of anybody whilst he's here. And that is the person that would need much more vetting, and that is why they need to appear in person, and we would need to be able to do a much better vetting or clearance for such travel coming into South Africa. With a corporate worker, that corporate worker is always under the control of the employer, and the employer is obligated to report to the department periodically about the workers, where they are, and whether they all still in his or her employ. Chairperson, with regard to the issue of the amendment being constitutionally compliant, we think it is, and we could ask the parliamentary legal advisor to comment on that. With regard to what systems are in place, Honorable Zwane, for vetting we have been verification of it. We have, in our missions abroad, people now have to apply before they come to South Africa at our missions abroad. So they would apply at, let's say, in China. When they apply, they would need to give us certain documentation, their bank details, the fact that if they are working there, or who are they working, and if they are working full-time, they would need to give us release clearance certificates. So all of that verification is done with the local authorities in their country. So you would do the checking with the local authorities. It is much better to do the vetting in the home country or the country of origin than when the person applying for a visa in country like the previous act allowed. Now you would need to apply in your home country. The vetting is done there, and we are and you are able to do a better vetting and do a better verification because you are able to do it with the local authorities there.
No, thank you. You want to come in? Let me just remember you. Anyone wants to follow up before I do my follow up, so that when you respond, you cover also my follow up. For me, the more you explain, it becomes more complicated for me, especially the corporate visa. Let me start with the question. I hear that either way it's covered from what members raised, but I just want to take on the second, let's say whether individual or corporate. How do you validate the medical certificate? Let's say corporate. A person gets involved in an accident last day or 3 months before. Then the farm owner or the company, the mining company, comes and informs Home Affairs that this person was involved in an accident. How do you validate that, Home Affairs? How do you know it's true? No, not anything is possible. How do you know that they are telling you the truth? Whether the doctor's medical certificate is a valid one. How do you validate that? Do you have tools as Home Affairs to deal with that? That is one thing. The second matter on the corporate visa, as you explained, to say, for me, it becomes even more complicated. If the farm owner, from Orange season, talking about my province now, very rich in Orange, and they come and say they're applying for a visa for 300 people, do you have the name attached as Home Affairs? My question, my initial question was that do they go through the same process of vetting? Because they're human beings. If I know that I'm not cleaning my country, I can go through the process. If we're not vetted in that process, are they vetted like individuals who apply? Or they just come in through the name of the farm owner without them being vetted? Because we think the farm owner is responsible or accountable for them. The second matter, is it not promoting exploitation of those farm workers by the farm owner because he's holding a visa? It's up to him. If they are not doing what he or she wants them to do, he can do anything because, like to me, he owns the visa. It's up to him whether he wants them or not. The third matter is why I'm saying it's becoming more complicated. How does it contribute to unemployment of the local people from the country? When do we agree? Because you find that in that area there are South Africans who can work in the farm. But the farm owner decides to get foreign workers only. I know some of the questions are not relating to you. They are labor in nature. But I'm just looking at if farm owners or mining companies are not abusing this act to exploit foreign workers, and also in the expense of local people who might have got that job, but because we've got an open-ended policy which does not say you can employ up to this number, I'm not saying you must limit them, but you can't have all of them foreign. for that reason, yet as South Africans, we are looking for a job. I'm just thinking aloud, you may answer some of them, some you may not, because they are more labor in nature.
Thank you, Chairperson. These are, when it comes to immigration issues, these are always the issues that are being asked, and I think these are also some of the questions raised by Honourable Chairperson are also policy matters which our Green Paper is also trying to address in some way, because these are the realities that we face. If we could maybe start with the tools for validation. Chairperson, it's not a word of mouth. Someone just doesn't come and say individual X is in the hospital extent. No, we want to know first proof of that. Hospital note, doctor's letter, and all of that. So there's proof. If there is reason for us to doubt anything, we have an inspectorate unit that we send out to the hospitals, and we phone the doctor, we verify with the doctor. So we do have tools and stuff to be able to verify whether someone is telling us the truth or not. And you can be assured that person, we check on these issues. That is why some of them complain that it takes a little long or that it's a lengthy process. But we have to do that because we need to check up on every application that is made. With regard to the labor laws, firstly, maybe let's go to the issue of does it contribute to unemployment. When you apply, our law states that you 60% of your workforce has to be South African. 60%. The other 40% you can employ using foreigners. Now, in this case over here, especially when it comes to issues like in the rural areas, the argument with the farmers is that with the rapid rise in urbanization and the migration from rural, sorry, rural to urban, that they are losing a lot of people in the rural areas that are working on farms. And this is the reason they give to Department of Labor, for instance. And Department of Labor had investigated these issues, because all of our applications now has to go through the Department of Labor. And only when the Department of Labor says to us, we've checked everything and you can issue a corporate visa to interview to farm X or whoever, do we issue. It is also the amendment of the current amendment that allows us to do that. In the past, it was different. Home Affairs could take that decision on its own. But now it is done in consultation with the Department of Labor. So the Department of Labor then needs to be satisfied that, firstly, that 60% of your workforce is South African, and that you indeed need 300 workers to work for you. Maybe if I could read this. An application for a corporate visa shall be accompanied by a proof of the need to employ the requested number of foreigners, a certificate by the Department of Labor confirming, one, that despite a diligent search, the corporate applicant was unable to find suitable citizens or permanent residents to occupy the positions available in corporate entity, and job description and proposed remuneration in respect to each foreigner, and the salary and benefits of any foreigner employed by the corporate applicant shall not be inferior to the average salary and benefits of citizens or permanent residents occupying similar positions in the Republic, and of course proof of registration with the SARS, with the unemployment fund and things like that. So, Chairperson, when it comes to not promoting abuse, you can see that our labor laws are applicable, and it makes sure that there is no abuse of such workers while they are in the employ of these employees. Yes, they are named. Every corporate certificate is attached to a person in the name. So when we go out with our inspectorate, or when we go out with the labor inspectorate, they are able to say, individual X, where is your, this is the list of workers that are on the farm, and this is the list of, workers, and with every worker we should find a certificate that has been issued in lieu of the corporate visa.
Maybe just to add on the process of application. When the farmer, as an example, is issued with the corporate visa that says you are allowed to employ 30, he goes to look for the people, and mostly there will be specific requirements because they're different types of sectors. Maybe go to the mine, you might need someone with a minimum requirement. So admission, you're going to issue the certificate to the person you wish to employ. Then they have to go to the mission to make an application so that we check the passport, is it there, is it... You know, there's still some verification process that we do. Then also check the certificate that you have, is it similar to the one that we issued to the employer, so that we are able to link you to the employer. And in most cases, usually the employers will have people that, you know, they transport them mostly to the mission to go and do the process in you know, as a group also. And then so that, and as and when they are issued with those visas, they are allowed to come into the country. They get to the port, they would have uploaded the information on the system. So as they scan the passport, it then shows this is the person and falling under employer A also. So those verifications are always applicable. So as DDG was reading, there's a whole lot of requirements for example, those who do seasonal or those who might be in the mining that we are trying to assist in dealing with the issues. Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, with regard to whether the bill is constitutionally compliant, I say that the bill is constitutionally compliant for the reason that it is regulating foreigners who overstay our country. Now, no foreigner has the right to enter our country without the valid visa requirements. Just like we can't go to America or to the UK without getting the visa. So a visa is the authority to enter a country, and to enter a country for a certain period of time and also sometimes on certain conditions. Now what this bill is about, it's about making sure that foreigners who willfully overstay, because that had happened in the past, and as you will recall from the briefing that we made in May, the manner in which this was dealt with before was that if a foreigner overstays, so in other words, the date of the expiry of the visa has come and gone, but because you're enjoying the sunshine in South Africa, decides to just stay here. What would then happen is that when they want to leave the country, they would be issued with a fine. And at the time, that fine was no more than 3,000 rand. So when they got to the port of departure, the official would say, oh, you're going to stay here by 4 to 5 days. I'm issuing you with the fine. And for most foreigners, 3,000 rand would have been nothing. So they would pay the fine, and the next time they would come here, and they could do the same thing, knowing that all that they would be penalized with is a fine. So the department found that this wasn't deterring people from respecting their visa conditions. With the result, this amendment is coming along so that there's no longer the payment of a fine. It's not going to be that easy. If you don't respect the laws of our country or the conditions of the visa of that our country issues you, and there is no valid reason like hospitalization or whatever else the exceptional circumstances might be, it means that the department will now say, if you're the first offender, sorry, you're not going to be allowed to enter our country for the next 3 months. So hopefully that's going to make people not overstay for no valid reason. And also, if you look at our constitution, when it comes to the right to enter the republic, it states that every citizen, not foreign national, a citizen of this country, has the right to enter, to remain in, and to reside in the republic. So only South African citizens would have a right to enter. Foreign nationals must abide by our laws. We are regulating border control here, like every other country does, for various reasons. Work maybe. I mean, you cannot have an influx of people come here and be here illegally, because our constitution allows everyone in the country access to resources. But if you're here on a valid visa and things like that, you can access those resources. But if you willfully overstay, then you've contravened our Immigration Act. And this is the penalty that will then apply to you. Thank you.
Dr. Kamula? If you have contravened the Immigration Act of South Africa and you have applied for a visa for 3 years to get into a country in subject or commonwealth or whatever, does it affect you? Now, does it affect only in respect, with respect to your application to South Africa, or does it affect you internationally?
The department can correct me if I'm wrong, but other countries would have their own requirements. they might have a requirement that says, we're going to look to see whether you've been rejected a visa in another country. Because when you fill in a UK visa application, that's one of the questions. Have you ever been rejected a visa? But that's for that country to regulate. We have our immigration laws. If you've constantly our immigration laws, our penalties will apply to you.
Sorry, Melissa. I think they've answered all the questions that we've asked based on the submission, because we're dealing with the submission. We'll then have to approve the bill, the amendment bill. We need a quorum. A quorum will do help. But I will need to get hands that are supporting the amendment bill. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think the bill is duly, the amendment bill is duly approved. Thank you very much. Yeah, we will be waiting for the processes of the grant, because most of the issues, some of them that were raised, belong to the process. It's just that they're long overdue. You know, when you hear something little bit, then you just put in everything. But we will be waiting for the processes until it comes to ourselves. Then we either act. Thank you very much, honourable members, and the department.
Thank you,
Parliament. We are done with this one. Thank you. Okay, honourable members, I have to read the report as we usually do it when we finalize the report of the Select Committee on Social Services. Report on the Select Committee on Social Services on the Refugees Amendment Bill, Immigration. Yeah, it's supposed to be Immigration Amendment Bill. Bill 5 of 2016, National Assembly, Section 75, date 16 August 2016. The Select Committee on Social Services, having considered the subject of the refugees, immigration. Immigration. Okay, refer to it. Report that it has agreed to the bill. I'm just struggling with the, yeah. Members, I will just change the refugees and put immigration, because there was a type of error under here. Then this is the report that we're submitting, that we have considered the bill and approved as the committee. Can we proceed? I think we're done. Thank you very much, honourable members. Waiting, the team's agreement. We're waiting for the team from Human Sentiment to come in.
Yeah, the name on you. Thank you very much. Can we start already? Yes, ma'am, we're ready. I'm not sure whether we should start with introductions again. Do we know each other? Would you?
Yes, I will do the introduction.
You will do the introduction?
Yes, I will check.
Okay, all members, we are getting a presentation from Department of Human Settlement with their entities and entities. I don't know whether it's a person or an entity, people, but they will clarify that as they do their presentation. But just to remind members, all members, we got a presentation just before we closed. Why we could not conclude the regulations, we're not dealing with the Act per se, but we're dealing with the regulations in line with the Act, is because it was not prepared to us from the NA. Then we said as soon as we open, we will, once it is referred to us, we'll then consider the regulations and conclude on the matter. We were supposed to have the department at 11:30. The leader of the delegation, informed that she is still on the way. The DG is attending the cabinet report by the deputy, the second in charge is on the way. We'll give that person an opportunity as soon as he comes or she comes. But for now, I will allow the presentation, but for that, the introduction, let me start with the members. Would you introduce yourself first time if I'm not mistaken? I'm sure you still remember us, or you will want us. You don't remember us. And I suggest that you write down. So the next time when we meet, we don't introduce ourselves again. My name is Kathy Dalini, the chairperson of the OCLS Committee on Social Services.
I am Safanoredi Mampuru, the committee whip and the member of this committee representing the Mpoko province. Following the King Rasamka, only late on the Pumaka, only Luna, the committee.
My name is Ndomo Tekaula, member of the committee representing the kingdom. Of one group. Natal.
My name is Linus Swan, a member of the committee representing KZN.
Good morning, Chris Harding. I'm from the Northeast Province, member of the committee.
My name is Lee Laroon. I'm one of the researchers for the committee.
Good morning, I'm from the
I'm the chairperson of the board of the community schemes on my services. That is referred to as CISOS.
I'm Advocate Deme. I'm the director of legal services in the National Department of Human Settlements.
My name is Dicky Dube. I'm the adjudicator general at CISOS.
My name is Nitsati Wotini. I am the provincial ombudsman for CISOS.
Good morning, honourable members. My name is Kevin Gwenya. I'm from the FAPJ Service Board.
Good morning, Chair, honourable members. My name is Brian Chaplow. I'm the CEO of the State Agency Affairs Board.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honourable members. My name is Sharon Horton. I'm with the Department of Human Settlements in the Ministry. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Zoe Adams from Human Settlements in the Ministry.
Okay, no, thank you very much. I hope it's the person that we're waiting for.
Yes.
Okay, let me give you a breather. Let me start with her person. Just to introduce the presentation, and then you'll tell us how you find the presentation. But bear in mind that this is a repeat. You just recap in from what you did instead of going to detail of the presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and Honorable Members. The way we have planned the presentation is mainly to put the previous presentation into context, because we got the feeling that maybe Honorable Members were not very much aware of the context of the regulations that we presented. So the advocate, Dele, will lead us in the presentation. She will deal more in the first part, which will be the context upon which the community schemes ombudsman is established, and then quickly run through what we already presented without, as Honorable Chair said, delve into detail about it. So without any further ado, I don't know if maybe Mr. Daney will get the opportunity first to address the committee, or we can just go straight to the presentation.
Okay, I'll give him that opportunity to introduce, but just indicate that we will allocate time. We'll give you 30 minutes for everything. Everything. I hope you'll be able to do that. If the department is want to introduce this, or should we go straight? Okay. Can we start with the presentation? But I'm giving 30 minutes for everything.
Mr. Cheney won't say anything. We'll go straight to the presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson, for this opportunity. We previously presented this regulation to yourself before the you had to operate. So CISOs and Sexual Harassment Schemes Management Regulation, CISOs has already been indicated by the Chairperson Means Community Schemes Ombudsman Service. And there is an Act of CISOs, and there is an Act, Sectional Harassment Management Act, which were assented to by the President in 2011. So these are the regulations which are now talking to the particular pieces of legislation which have to be promulgated or come into operation once the regulations have been approved and signed off by the Minister. So just to give the background about the community schemes. South Africa's real estate sector was among the main contributors of GDP, 2.1% growth in 2012, and the total community scheme sector is valued at approximately 3 billion rand. That was the as of 2012. Sectional title schemes are among the fastest growing forms of accommodation owing to a number of reasons, including heightened security, affordability, and a more communal way of life. It is estimated that 200,000 sectional title schemes are there, over 1 million units in the country. And the community scheme managers are said to manage assets in excess of 800 billion and approximately 11 billion in annual levies. And this is a sector which in the past has not been regulated, and the government saw it proper that they should actually establish this source and have a regulator of this sector. The background again, it just shows that before CISOs, there's been no effective regulation of the sector. No quality check and control of key governance documents such as body corporate rules and home owner association. Often people confuse estate agents and the managing agents. Here we're talking more about managing agents who are managing this estate, the homeowners association, or we're actually managing the body corporate, as we know that people live in communities, in community schemes and so forth. So what CISOs is about is also to tackle the issue of education and awareness among consumers. Those who buy into the schemes need to be more educated and aware of their rights. There's lack of effective dispute resolution mechanism in this space. When people are aggrieved within the body corporate space where they have bought properties within homeowners association, there is no effective dispute resolution, which is now going to be provided for by CISOs. There used to be high arbitration and litigation costs to settle even minor disputes under the Arbitration Act before the CISO came into place. So people had to resort to this. And if you didn't have the money to go through an arbitration process, then you have to be sitting with your dispute and be aggrieved while you're bought into this particular housing scheme. The power imbalance and financial matter between an ordinary individual unit owner and body corporate managing agent, homeowners association, it serves as a deterrent. So people will feel a lot more able now to deal with their issue through the CISOs instead of not knowing where to go for assistance once the CISOs is fully operational. The establishment, can I interrupt by the hand?
Okay.
I decided to eat my tea because I was not going to during fall. I had to look at the post myself. Is it a revised presentation? Because according to the chairperson, what we did last time, you said you needed a bit more background into CISOs and sectional titles. So we just added a bit of background. That's what I'm just trying to explain what community schemes are. And then the presentation as you go forth is the same. We just added, I think, two or three pages just to explain what community schemes are. But we sent through a presentation, a revised one, which added this new slide. But it's not changing anything. It's just to explain.
We are not accusing anyone.
Okay.
All what you are saying, what you are reading, the members does not have the same thing. Ideally, we need to have what you are reading must have exactly the same documentation, which is what they are circulating now, because we received that copy.
Yes,
can we proceed?
Okay, thank you.
I think I'm just on the second page of the presentation.
Can I proceed?
Yes, thank you. The establishment of the community mobile service now marks the beginning of a new regulatory regime which has never existed in our country. This was established to Italy in terms of 34 of the CISOs Act to do the following: to develop and provide an alternative dispute resolution service for community schemes that is cost-effective and provides value for money, to provide training and general education on rights and obligations in community schemes, as I've already indicated. It's going to be dealing with conciliating disputes, adjudicate, and deal with issues of trustees, of body corporates, owners, occupiers, managing agents, and any other person the CISOs may deem fit necessary as long as it's in the context of the Act. Regulate, monitor, and control the quality of all sectional title schemes, governance documentation, and such other scheme governance documentation as may be determined by the Minister by notice in the Gazette. The main function of CISOs as a regulator is actually to have this community scheme document, which used to be lodged with the this registry, and now moving over to the CISOs, and there's a provision in the Act which is now providing for that, so that they are able to check that the governance documents which govern the body corporates are actually in line with our constitution, also in line with other laws of the country. So this is the main function of CISOs as it is a regulator in this space. And then the dispute resolution which I mentioned about is an aspect of functions of CISO. The fact that may be called community ombuds service is not entirely focused on dealing with disputes. The main task of CISOs is to regulate the space which has not been regulated, as I've indicated, how big this industry is, and it has not been regulated for a long time until government saw fit that there should be a regulation of this market. So CISOs also is to take over control and preserve and provide access to all sectional titles and other scheme governance documents and ensure quality assurance and promote and monitor good governance of community schemes and to ensure that they enforce the Sectional Titles Management Act. There was also a benchmarking with certain sectors in other countries of sectional titles. And a trip to NATO, Australia and Singapore in order for the department to do this study and in the past. And the portfolio committee apparently was also involved. And this culminated in the Community Schemes Act of 2011 and the Sectional Titles Scheme Management Act being promulgated in 2011 and assented to by the president. And then we started then working on these regulations, and we know that the power to make regulations actually lies with the minister. And once they are done, and the provisions of this piece of legislation provides that the CISOs regulations as well as the Sectional Titles Act have to come through Parliament, and this is what we are doing as well. We are going to be seeking your approval. After that, the minister
is supposed to sign a piece of regulation so that then we approach the president to now operationalize the two acts which were promulgated in 2011. So I'm going to go into the provisions which talk to the minister, basically that she's the one who's responsible for the regulations to ensure that they are signed off. As part of the regulations process, we had consultation in all the provinces last year. It started off by the minister publishing the draft regulations in terms of Section 29 of the CISOS Act and Section 19 of the Sectional Titles Management Act in the Government Gazette, which was done on the 2nd of October 2015 for public comments. And then between the 14th of October 2015 and the 3rd of November 2015, we went across the country for public participation and got inputs from stakeholders. And the total of 746 stakeholders attended the sessions nationally and made their input. And this is a slide that actually is depicting the participation as we went per province, showing the Gauteng province being the biggest participation that we had in terms of the figures, and the Northern Cape being least. And we received this comments, which we applied amongst them. Some of them actually even went into this. And one thing that I must say, that the regulations before we went into publishing them for public comment, we went through the process of also giving them to the state law advisor as it was required, and the state law advisors indicated that they are happy with the regulations, they are compliant with all the rules and the acts of the country and the constitution. So in addition to the public consultations that I'm talking about, there were also close focus group sessions which were held during November 2015 with the following: the Office of the Register of Deeds, and as I indicated, a lot of documents which were now used to be lodged with these offices are now going to be moving to CISOS. So we have also agreement between our department and that of Rural Development for the transfer of these documents over to the CISOS to start operating a new one after the full operation. And we have had engagement with NAMA, an Association of Residential Communities. Furthermore, there were radio interviews with CISOS board members and Chief Ombuds, Adjudicator General, Provincial Ombuds by the following radio stations. Just to mention a few, not the list is not exhaustive. There are some which may not be mentioned here. And then were also newspaper articles published nationally about the regulations so that we could get input of the public. The total of 1,648 written comments were received from the general public and stakeholders. And in summary, the comments are as follows. Amongst others, it shows a lot of support for the establishment of CISOS to deal with corruption of body corporates, managing agents and trustees and so forth, because the public felt that because of lack of an entity like CISOS, they've really not had a space where to refer their issues. And we know that when you had complaints, the only process would be either through the arbitration process that I mentioned, which was expensive, or through the court. So the establishment of CISOS, at least there's a way that people can now, they know where they can refer their disputes to. If they're unhappy with the body corporate, instead of just talking about their corruption, they know where to go. CISOS and government to address mismanagement and neglect of inner city flats and rogue landlords. This was one of the issues which was raised during public comment. A concern was raised about CISOS' internal capacity and state of readiness to collect levies. The concern about reliance on municipal valuation to determine levy payable to CISOS due to alleged inefficiency in the municipalities that will cause an administrative burden on the sector. And it recommended a model based on a percentage of the current monthly levy paid by owners rather than relying on municipality valuation. And the concern was raised about well-run schemes and higher income groups cross-subsidizing lower income groups and suggesting flat rates to be paid by all. So I don't want to read all the summary of comments, but basically these were comments which were raised
during the public participation, because amongst other things that CISOS is going to be doing will be to collect levies. It is envisaged that levies, I mean, CISOS is supposed to be self-sustainable in the long term, and it will be self-sustainable also once it starts collecting these levies. And I'm going to be presenting just how these levies are going to be collected. In terms of the application process, which is there for dispute resolution, there's also a fee, but it is a low cost, and it is not an expensive cost, because we as CISOs would like parties to be able to approach CISOs whenever they have issues or disputes within where they are living. I'd like to get into the CISOs regulations quickly. The CISOs regulations, regulation 1 provides for definitions, 2 provides for board activities, 3 provides for notices of meetings of the board, 4 provides for the quorum of meetings of the board, 5 provides for adjournments of meetings, 6 provides for the presiding officers for meetings of the board, 7 provides for procedures and making of decision meetings, 8 provides for the meetings of the board, 9 provides for written resolution taken without convening a meeting of the board, 10 provides for execution of documents but validity and action seeking by the board, 11 provides for scheme levies and service fees. It provides for the types and amounts of levies and when such levies and fees become payable. And regulation 12 provides for service fees and costs and further provides for rate of discount or waiver of fees with detail of qualification for such discount or waivers. 13 provides for payment of interest on overdue levies and the amount payable to the service. 40 provides for duty of schemes, executive. 15 provides for fidelity insurance against the risk of loss of money belonging to him suffered as a result of an act of fraud or dishonesty committed by any insurable person. And regulation 16 talks to quality and form of governance documentation. And I've touched on this and I said that it's a major function of CISO to ensure that the governance documents of body corporate are of the quality assurance, ensuring that they comply with the constitution and the laws of the country. 17, regulation for purposes of the services training function in terms of the Act and regulation provides for accreditation of training courses by the service. And 80 provides for scheme governance documentation information, which includes annual return certificates and so forth. 19 provides for dispute resolution, submission of application for dispute resolution. 20 provides for circumstances where legal representation can be permitted. And 21 provides for the notice relating to an appeal against the decision of an adjudicator. In terms of our dispute resolution, as I said, it's a cost-effective process. The provision provides how parties are going to be referring their matters to CISOs. There is a conciliation process. And where parties are not happy with the outcome, they can refer the matters to adjudication. And there is also an appeal process where the parties are not happy with the decision of the adjudicator. And there is no provision for an appeal. Because this one has not been fully operational, they are waiting for the regulations, however, they've been doing conciliation of disputes. And to indicate that, to show that this the CISOs is really needed out there, there have been a number of disputes already which have been settled through the CISOs while CISOs are still waiting for these regulations, because they cannot embark on the adjudication yet, but they have been doing the conciliation. Regulation 22 provides for the power of the adjudicator to enter and inspect any premises. And obviously, this is within the context of the Act, whereby the parties would have agreed, obviously, that, or in the case that the adjudicator finds that it is important to enter the premises in order to resolve a dispute that exists. Levies and fees regulation. Regulation 1 talks to the definitions. Regulation 2 provides for the levies payable by a unit within the community scheme in terms of Section 29(1)(b). Regulation 3 provides for fees payable for the use of the service, including inter alia, the application and adjudication referrals.
4, provide for the discount and waiver of fees as set out in section 29.1. I'm going to go now to the levy formula. The levy formula is paid by people who are living within the sectional title schemes and homeowners association. The levy formula was actually worked out by an actuarial scientist. And by the way that we wanted it to be done, it to charge as little an amount as possible, but an amount that is not going to be just too heavy for the communities, while it is also something that will be making CISOs to be self-sustainable. The levy formula...
Can I come in? Remember at the beginning I indicated that this is added information that we said we want to get some of the issues. I know this one will deliberate on some of this information.
Mm.
If you can just speak to them instead of reading word by word some of the information. I'm just looking at the time left with 3 minutes or so.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I think actually I'll just go back to for you to recap, look at the schedule, which just shows the levies. That if you are paying a levy between 0 and 500 rand already in a sectional title, you would not pay anything in terms of the source levy schedule. And it is capped at 2,500. If you are paying 2,500 and above, the levy that one would pay would be 40 rand. So that is the levies. I think I basically covered on most of the issues because I tried to summarize them in terms of what Sectional Title Schemes Management Act is about and the CISOs regulations, and that the important thing is for CISOs to regulate this market, which has not been regulated for a long time, to provide training for consumers so that they know their rights and to know where to refer their disputes if they are disputes, in terms of managing agents within the state on which, in which they are living, that the CISOs is there. And the CISOs is to ensure that the documents are to ensure quality assurance of this, on the documents that are now going to be moving from this registry over to the CISOs. What we would request is that the regulations are approved so that CISOs really can start to be fully operational, and the minister, once the minister can sign the documents, because then it will still be that process of the president also bringing the two acts into operation, which were promulgated in 2011. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I will open to members to deliberate, but again, bearing in mind that this is a second briefing. Which has been said, it looked like members were not, once the person said this, it seems that they did not understand it. Now, as the presentation was done, you could pick up, it was not a question of understanding, it was additional information which we requested as a committee. As you were doing the presentation, outlining the process, it came up that there was even a trip to do further studies on this matter where the portfolio committee was involved. I'm coming to this matter which I've been raising for quite some time now. Parliament committee has got equal status. You know, when you leave the committee that is supposed to approve behind, for me, the committee that has to approve, it needs to have as much information as possible. I'm sure when you do your responses, you indicate we're not there as members, but it's a committee. I'm talking about the committee now. Why portfolio committee? Why left absolute committee? Because you can't conclude with the portfolio committee as you are here now, expecting the committee to approve. But in the process of getting more knowledge on these games, the third committee was left out. Maybe one day we'll give an explanation, we don't know, because I just don't get it. Why treating parliament committees differently? I'll open to members to deliberate
on this presentation so that we conclude the matter. All members, there is a briefing.
So thank you, Chairperson. I actually took note of what you are referring to on the last page. You have said what you have said as a president, all of us. Thank you for the briefing. Thank you very much. You welcome the briefing. English is a second language to me. And I speak it as well. Is it system of regulation or regulations of the group?
It's not regulations.
I'm reading a system of regulation. That is why I'm confused. In your all of the pages. System of regulation.
It's regulation.
Yes. Oh, okay. Thank you. I took note of this. The issue of consumer education. Who is going to be taking care of that? Is it CISOS? Or is it CISOS in conjunction with the department, human segment? Are you going to be developing modules, or is it corporate bodies that are going to be educating people? Who is going to be responsible for that particular aspect?
Thanks for this brief briefing. I also want to echo the concerns of our chairperson. I had planned to do it in a different way, to say I now understand why we were confused the last time they made a presentation with regard to the background, because this was like asking a grade 12 to lecture to tertiary students. Because this started long ago and most of us are not there. And they also went to Singapore and Australia for benchmarking. We were not there, most of us, almost all of us. There were provincial consultations where the Portfolio Committee was taken on board. We were not there. But now, at the tail end of it, we have to as grade 12, we have to lecture to tertiary. That is why it makes it difficult, Honorable Chairperson, like you say. I just have a few questions, Honorable Chairperson. They have benchmarked. But I just want to, in a layman's language, so that I understand it properly, what actually triggered this legislation and the regulations? There is too much of governing our lives in the world. What wrong was there before the establishment of this entity? And what good is it going to do? Or is it just this business to want to govern us? I'm one of those people who just want to come and come into my house and govern me. There's too much of governing. I just want to understand, what good is this going to do? Which was not happening before the NDC was established. That's what I'm trying to explain. And, I also want to refer to site somewhere where you talk about principles. You are saying a very good thing. I've complained previously about, you know, this thing in South Africa, that there is so much of pirating, there is so much phasing out, but it is not given time frames. You say here that government support, government fund is going to be phased out. There is no time frame. Then you put a time frame to that. You are saying this also will be self-sustainable. After how long? Is it something that you have put your mind into? Can you put a time frame to it? Or it will be there non-stop. Each time you come to us, we are phasing out. Each time you come to us, we are phasing out. What is the time frame of the phasing out? When are you planning, anticipating there to be able to be self-sustaining and in the whole?
No, thank you very much. Let me just add mine before they respond. As a committee, we're trying our best to add value in any process, not just for ourselves. Because the document is in front of us, we do want to add value. That is why maybe we are raising this issue. Maybe the department will take this up and try to correct it. It's not only this matter, there are a number of matters. Members did raise their issues in the past. But the parliament committees, let's do them the same way, because all parliament committees, so let's try our best in doing that. So that when you come here, you know that we're not going to say approved or agreed. At least we add value because of course, information and knowledge. The one question that I have is that, is it constitutionally compliant? We don't want to be challenged more. We've already raised our weakness, our shortfall in this process because the fact that we're new as members, but also the interaction of the leg committee in part was not at the level where it was expected to be. On page slide number 11, you've mentioned that you did not list all the media houses or whatever they. If I may ask a question, why? Because for me, if you openly confess that you left out some, why did you leave out some? I was not there. I don't know who are those. Why are you leaving them out? And be expected to approve. Why are they left out? What are the reasons, if there are reasons? If you are challenged tomorrow, what do we say as a committee? Because now this becomes our product now. Once we approve it, it's out of your hands. It's our product. How do we defend as a committee? Why did we leave some out? Why are they not listed here? If one could be given a reason, why are they not listed here? Then, I think the other matter that I want to raise, you should not feel that we have been, we're not difficult, in fact, we're doing what we're supposed to do. We are a government entity. We are going to do oversight over this, as we do oversight to the department. As part of the entity of the department, we will also be doing oversight over you. So it's important to understand these things. I'm glad that the CFO is here. And the chairperson of the board is here. Our experience in some of the boards. See, now we don't have money issues because we have not started implementing. We are getting into a very critical period where now you would be implementing. Issues will start to come up and will be expected as a committee to intervene. Don't want to talk about these things. We must say upfront. Go and do a clean job. We are going to do oversight. We're telling now upfront on what we are presenting. We're not going to do oversight on something else. What you're presenting to us, we're going to do oversight. You're telling us that this is how what you're going to do, this is how you're going to do it. We'll be doing oversight over this, what you're saying to us. The last matter from my side is the issue of deep levies. Beginning of the presentation, it was indicated even last time that some of these property agents, whatever you call them, they've got different names, they overcharge the communities. But now we are adding, not getting this money from those boards, taking it again from the overcharged communities. What does it mean? Are we a caring government? Where does it put us? I'm talking now as government. We are openly saying that we are being overcharged. We want to regulate. That has been too overchargeable again. I'm not saying that you are aware, I'm just asking a question. Was there any other way of getting this money other than getting from the overcharged people?
What are these bosses paying? The agencies, what are they paying? Why are we not getting this money from them? Can we respond?
Okay, thank you, Chair. I don't know if I can put this on record, Chair. Can I please go ahead?
Oh, you don't have
to. I don't have a comment. Thank you, Chair. Just to indicate on a couple of points, and I'll ask Edward Tseng and perhaps the Chair. I think in relation to the study visit that we conducted to Australia that was undertaken, I don't want to get the or leave the impression is that there was the portfolio committee was part of that visit. I think what we need to indicate is that Edward Tseng will indicate that subsequent to that, the benchmarking processes that took place, there was relevant processes that was followed in terms of involving the portfolio committee together with the select committee, and at the appropriate time, I'm aware of the fact that there were certain constraints in terms of the ability of the select committee to have been part of that. But we can give you a full detail of that. Chair, I just want to not leave the impression that we change, that we adopt an approach from the department point of view where there's a differential approach. Chair, I'd like to sort of indicate that is not the intention of the department or any of the entities. As we've indicated, Chair, we Parliament and the committee and the council approach is important, particularly in the work that we do. In fact, it's integral to a lot of the work that we do. So I don't want us to. I think if the portfolio or Chair, if you're under that impression, Chair, I'd like to sort of just indicate it is not the intention, and there's no intention on the part to do that, Chair. So in relation to the CISOS education processes, part of the levy process, and you'll see in the budget of what we indicated, is that the CISOS budget, as a result of the compilation or the collection of levies, must include an integral part of education. So it's part of that education process, given the history that we've coming from. So part of the operational budget will ensure that given the fact that previously your community schemes was only applied to in the higher income, I think what we need to indicate is that given the issues around densification, given the fact that we are maximizing utilization of land, there's a substantial amount of community schemes that have been introduced that will have lower income households benefiting. And when you do that, Chair, I think what we've indicated is that when you introduce that scheme, it's important that we take communities along, particularly in relation to the densities, to minimize conflict, to ensure that there's no abuse of households, to also ensure that in relation to the harmonization of that, of those communities where these schemes apply. So the education part is an important part, and I think as government, together with the entity, we've indicated it's an integral part. So the responsibility of ensuring that education and communities are in fact brought on board and are aware of their rights, because I think based on the history of where we come, on the rights based and the responsibilities, we part of that is what we want to do. Chair, the government and the grant that was that was referred by Members Wani, as the department in the formative stages of establishment of the CISOS, the department provided with National Treasury what we call the establishment grant. So there was a grant made available for the operational expenditure and some of the capital expenditure to set up offices in the formative stages. The issue was that as time goes on, when the levy kicks in, the grant will reduce. The intention being is that the entity should not be a drain on the fiscus, but it also should be self-sustaining. And then that comes back to the issue around the ability to afford the levies. Chair, in the determination of the levies, it was done in a way that did not place an undue burden on households. But also, Chair, we're aware of the fact, and in the process of establishing the CISO, we're aware of the fact that there's a substantial amount of abuse, there's conflict between managing agents, households who occupy those schemes, and there's been a situation where, in fact, households have been not getting the benefit, in fact, of their levies that they charge. Now, there's two levies, Chair. There's the levy that the managing agents charge in relation to that, and then there's this levy. Now, this levy is important in the sense that it's there to protect the rights, to also ensure that and there's transparency around it, as you indicated. This is an entity that will do that. So I think we need to be clear about the fact that it's an important part, and I don't think we're saying that 40 rand, I mean the minimum that is being proposed is 40 rand, and that's the maximum, the maximum that's being proposed is 40 rand. But in relation to that, it will then also be part of the process of the education, it will be part of the conflict, and there's a substantial amount of other interventions that will occur as a result of that, including the fact that part of CISO's responsibility will be to ensure the affordability of levies from managing agents and whether or not those levies are actually being utilized for the benefit of households in respect of that. Chair, I'll give it to Edward Singh and the CEO to just indicate what the process of the provincial consultations was. And that process.
Thank you, Chair. Just to address some of the issues, without actually belaboring this issue of the, because the CEO has already indicated why maybe perhaps you were not included. It's not because the department wanted to exclude any particular person or any particular parliamentary committee. But the fact is that when that trip was undertaken, it was in relation to the Act, when the two Acts were promulgated some years ago, not in terms of the regulation which we are presenting today. So that study is why it ended up only being the portfolio committee. I also don't understand. I suppose it was decided at that stage that they would do that study, which also led, I think, to the establishment of the CISOs and to ensure or to justify why this particular space should actually be regulated. And it goes to what was raised in terms of what good is it going, what good is CISOs brought, why should it be there, it's establishing then its existence. There was no regulation, as I indicated, before the CISOs was established. In this particular space, there are managing agents. The industry is doing it themselves. Like when we were going also for public participation, they are saying, why is government coming to do this? Because we are already doing it ourselves. We are doing our own training. We are doing our own dispute resolution. But the fact of the matter is that some parties are not necessarily happy in their space, which is there, created, or which exists, because government was not regulating. A lot of, because of our history, where we're coming from in South Africa, people were not living in these communities before. So when they move into this community, they're not even aware of the rules of being here. And they move in only after they bought the property and they're staying, and then they are told that this is how it's done here. You need to, they don't know even that they're supposed to attend the AGM, that they can actually determine who is on the body corporate and their rights, if there are certain things that they would like to be proposed into this
how they are governed. They just go there only to find that they are told what they have bought in, that now you have to pay this levy and that levy and the other. So CISOS is there to also check if these levies are really doing what they are supposed to. Because one of the communities, why people live in communities, is also to ensure that the value of the property or the properties are well looked after and preserved, so that, you know, it's value to the people who have bought into this property. And I just mentioned this because I remember it's an issue that was raised by one professor when we were having a discussion about the CISOs recently, because that is basically what living in communities is supposed to do. But I said, in terms of our country, it was in relation to the governance documents, which are now supposed to be laws of CISOs. Why should they be compliant with the constitution and the laws? Because they are rules which are made for that particular community where you move. So why should government interfere in that way and make sure that they are compliant with the constitution? But because of our history, where we're coming from, it's very important that we should ensure that these governance documents and the rules which govern people are compliant with the constitution and the laws of the country, because you know sometimes there can be provisions which are discriminatory in this document, which are excluding certain category of people, or because you happen to come from a particular race, you find that something which doesn't sit well with you. And before CISOs was there, there's nowhere else you can take it except maybe to take it to arbitration or to take it to the court. And because the costs are very expensive, it's a lengthy process, people would rather than live with that unhappiness within the body corporate. You won't just wake up tomorrow and leave your house because now you've already bought in because you didn't know something. So that is why we're saying CISOs is here to add value. And even when we went to public participation, it was really embraced. The stakeholders, even though they asked these questions, but in the end they realized that there's need for this regulation. And we're saying this sector is regulated in other countries. That is why this benchmarking is done, and we went to other countries to study what is happening and then see how we can adapt it to our own country so that it also works. This industry is collecting a lot of, I've mentioned the amount of money that are collected in terms of the body
corporate. My mic is off.
Okay.
No, I'm just saying conclude if you
can.
Because the reporting was already responded on some of the issues.
Okay, sure. Let me then just answer. Some of them, consumer education has just been, I think it was spoken about how important people need to know their rights and understand what they are buying into. Another question, the time frame, I think has also been mentioned, because there was a budget by government, but the sooner CISO starts operating and collecting the services, I think then we'll know the time frame in terms of when we can start. So within the levies themselves, there is a waiver. It's not to burden consumers, and if consumers cannot afford, they have to make a case to the minister to consider. But already we have said anybody paying a levy of 500 rand is not going to be paying anything. And then it is capped at 2,500 at 40 rand. Obviously, it will be revised, but it's also key that CISOs will be checking that these fees that are charged by body corporates are really adding them to people's properties and what they are getting what they are paying for. I think I've covered most of the issues, and the DBG has covered that. Yes, and I want to just say also the regulation.
Okay, let me just give one of the Kaula. He wanted to follow up so that when you answer that one, you also
covered. Thanks, sir. Quick one, an interesting one. The hotels, the older they are, body corporates, block chairman, and all those people. And also, we want to discuss costs as this comment. And we did an oversight on the block of flats, low cost block of flats, and there were issues around governance. Where do they fall? Those two categories. Thanks.
Currently, in terms of the legal process, there's approximately, in fact, the deeds office hasn't a clear idea of what the numbers is. But it's approximately 200,000 sectional title households fall within sectional title. So there's a formal regulated in terms of the law. So it affects approximately 1 million people. But as I've indicated, one of the things that we have to be able to do as government is be proactive, given the fact that there's going to be a substantially larger number of households that are going to be moving to, given the fact of the space. In relation to the issues that have been raised by Member Kaula on the hostels, those fall, and as part of the redevelopment, the crude redevelopment, as well as some of the overlap, one of the things that we have asked the CISOs to undertake is also to take a conflict and chief ombud ability, because one of the things that we have at the moment, what we don't have as government or as a society, is a cost-effective, non-judicial conflict or alternative dispute resolution mechanism. I think what we need to be very clear about is that Minister has indicated that we've got to be able to get an ombud. So one of the things that we're looking at is how do we sort of in future come back and look at expanding some of the abilities in relation to chief ombud to oversee sectional title, but also to be able to oversee situations where there's dense communal living. And that's why I think what we've spoken about is the community scheme. So it refers to communal. And our view is that the hostels or the redeveloped family units would fall under the ability, or the CISOs would be then given the responsibility to manage those disputes. In fact, to ensure that where that occurs, because we know what one of the things that we can't do is to be holding municipalities and local government who manage these hostels or these communal areas to fulfill their obligation. And it's become a self-regulatory issue. So as government, we've also got to be fair around that issue. Thanks.
Honorable
Sachin.
Thank you,
sir. Just on the schedule, it's a problem of the law should be not quoted on 490 on the table. Just on the numbers, it's not a million people, it's up 4 to 5 million people, about more than 1 million households, but 4 to 5 million people that would be affected by it. I would like to know how did we arrive at the list? What is the estimated budget of teachers are the figures that the monthly levy on the levy, is that a scientific calculation on a scientific basis, or is it just a figure and then we'll use the money that's coming in? I'm asking this because this may be a thing in the West. I would like to know how is this budget, how does it arrive at these figures? What is the estimated budget of officials, and what if this is insufficient? So if there is like a certain. Thank you.
Same lot of information that is required now. But also what we had requested in our last engagement was the structure. How are you structured? We had hoped that you were going to be fine because it will also go in line with what Honorable Hassan is asking now, the estimate budget. I don't know whether you do have those figures, especially your estimate budget, because we will want you to come up. Like I was saying earlier, we will be all doing our side based on what you are presenting to us. We want a realistic presentation to us. If you do have that information, I'm afraid my time is really out of our scheduled time for this. But if you do, just quickly respond to those issues.
Thank you, Chair. We do have the figures here with the CFO in terms of how we arrived at that amount. We in fact engaged an expert professor from Wales who came up with the model and how we arrived at the figures. We are ready to do that if we have the time. But in some of the issues that has been raised, like in respect of the address and the newspapers, we went throughout almost all of them, not all, but each and every province. We have been to Radio Metro, which you may have not have mentioned. We have in publications, New Destiny. We have been to Morning Live, just talking about CISOs. And then on the issue that has been asked by Honorable Mr. Kaula about the hostels, in terms of the act, CISOs is given five, homeowner association or communal living, but the S-Race does not limited to those five, which is basically sectional title, which is homeowners association, which is cooperatives, the retired villages, potato, and share block schemes. So the act gives us powers to even go and cover the issue of hostels.
Chair, just on the budget issue, Chair, if the committee will remember that as part of the budget in terms of the strategic plan as well as the annual performance plan, we did submit the projected figures. In relation to that, as the CEO indicated, there was an actual scientist that was actually employed to do that. And Chair, I think the figures are here and it was presented. It forms part of the APT as well as the strategic plan with the day. Chair.
Honorable Hartin wants to do a follow-up on that. Let me allow him so that when you respond, maybe you cover what he wants to say.
Well, I'm very happy with the response.
The person that it is here that it will not take calculations to present it to us. Like Honorable Kaula has stated, we were not all present from the start, so may we then please have the figures, the estimated income and the budget, as you said, is here and it's available. I thank them for going almost all the way, but just to give it to us, and I expect that it will then be going to your office very soon and be distributed to the committee members. Thank you.
Okay, suggesting that they give us a copy of the figures, then we circulate it to members. I think that is fair enough, but it does assume that we could, in a summarized way, because like now we're hiding some of the things, CFO, like give you an opportunity.
Thanks, just in a brief, the formula that was presented here, whereby it indicated that the scheme levy less than 500. The difference of that you multiply by 2%. It's calculated from the fact that on our consultative processes with the stakeholders, especially the industry, especially the biggest agent called National Association Management Agent, they propose that we should charge the 1%. That means the scheme levy minus the 500, in brackets, you multiply that with 1%. That would be the CISOs levy. But in terms of Section 22 of the CISOs Act, it indicates that CISOs must be able to survive, must be able to do what we call a cost recovery. At that level, CISOs will be able to survive. At 1%, that was proposed by the National Association Management Agent, CISOs will not be able to survive. That's why we propose that let's add a 1% to a 2%. With that, CISOs will be able now to sustain itself going forward. I get everyone's clear on that.
No, we are fine with that, but I think the document will assist because, you see, he asked two questions. Mm-hmm. The one question was, what informs the levy?
Mm-hmm.
The other question, what is the budget projection mm-hmm. of the CISO? So that budget projection should answer the question that he's asking. The one that you want, will it be able to sustain this? That is the question he's asking. Two questions that
speaking to each other. So the information that you're going to give us is going to assist to see. Because we don't want you to come here tomorrow and say, but this money is not enough, we need more money. You see, we need to be responsible ourselves. So it's important that we get that information. As I said, that you circulate to us, we look at the information. Maybe later, if there's a need for engagement, because it hasn't stopped us approving the regulations anyway. But we need that information so that at least ourselves, we are certified that we are heading for something that will be sustainable in the future.
Chair, thank you, Chair. What we'll do is through the Ministry and Office of the DG, we'll submit that to you in writing within the next 7 days, if that's okay.
Okay. So thank you very much. I just want to make one comment. DG, when members raise issues, I know it's not, it may not be the right platform to talk about what we raise about the treatment. We're not there by the time, but in the past 2 and few months, yes, we have a history of development. Let me just indicate that as a committee, we have an advantage of having more than one department. We are 2 committees in one. Every NCOP, you're not responsible for one department. This particular committee, social services, are responsible for 5 departments. In addition to that, there is education and recreation. Honorable Zwane is the chairperson of that committee. 4 departments, meaning that collective we have 9 departments. Mm. So we have experience of all these 9 departments, including yourself.
Sure.
So when members raise issues, they are informed. Mm. Don't just dismiss them and say, I don't want us to go up with the impression that we are isolating another committee. Mm. It's not the right platform. It's a method that needs to be attended to. All what I'm saying, when members of these issues take interest, want to know why this issue is being raised, the manner in which it's being raised. The issue, not only with this issue, it's a number of incidents. I'm sure you have noticed that members are not all members are attending issues of the department. Maybe it's informed with some of the issues, but this is not the right platform. It needs the department and the committee to be addressed. But I'm just saying to you, don't just miss issues when members are raising issues. Thank you very much. All members, we need to approve these regulations. Can I have hands to support the regulations so that we can start with the implementation? Can't wait to do oversight. Can I have hands? Yeah, there are so many issues that we have raised that still need to be tied up. But can I have hands to support you? Thank you.
Can I agree with my colleague? If we just look at this one that was already presented, and this is part of the problem. You won't see the word select committee on this paper. We just add on some other thoughts that suddenly arose to make the regulations go through. We were not part of this process, and we were not privy to the deliberations and the questions as the whole thing developed over a period. So, Chair, I need to know what the basis, the court issues will lie in the levies that will be paid. And we've heard where this industry is saying something else. And we need to know, how do we arrive at this levy, at this level? What you're asking us here is to sign a blank check. I'm not prepared to do that.
Yeah, I was done.
Yes, sir, I have got to say because we do respect you also, you already called upon us to vote on the issue.
now we are reversing to raise issues that probably we have an opportunity to raise in our subsequent meeting or after we've engaged with the budget that we are owing and the organogram of this entity. Have allocated and then raise issues, moving forward. But you've already voted, to my understanding.
No, it's open. I was wondering if you heard what I said. First question was the people who are supporting it. I can say people who have concerns or issues, then we take a decision based on that. But our history as a committee, we tried our best, even those from different political parties who have consensus. We just approved one bill now, before this one. We had some issues that we raised, but with the responses and everything, we were able to, all of us, agree on the bill. That's what we strive to do as a committee at this level, because it's very important. So like tomorrow, we don't have to go to court, because we amongst ourselves, did not agree. So, can I give the committee with you?
Thank you very much, Justin. I want to agree with all the government to say that, with all the concerns raised, I think the department is able to listen to what we need. As a left committee, we needed to be treated with the dignity that it also deserves us to treat you. Because one day you'll come here. I'm the committee woman. One day you come here, do the same. We'll treat you back to control. I don't know what you'll tell the minister. It's high time that you put up our hopes. We respect one another. For the sake of the people of Tanzania, it's not about us here. It's about the constituencies that we are representing. It's about the people that we serve. We serve them. If any member is in a different group, chapter, you can determine if you have a quorum, you can vote as president. Thank you.
I did not want to come to that, but let me read this report. The report of the Select Committee on Social Services on the draft regulations on levies and fees pertaining to the community schemes, combat services, dated 16 August 2016. The Select Committee on Social Services, having considered the draft regulations on levies and fees pertaining to the community schemes, combat services, made in terms of Section 29(1)(b) and (c), D and E of the Community Schemes Ombuds Service Act 2011, Act 9 of 2011. And submitted to the Parliament for approval in terms of Section 29(3) of the Act referred to it recommends that the House approve the draft regulations. I've already got a support, majority are supporting the bill, but it means we are approving the bill with concern. Approving, we never did it before, it's our first experience. It never happened before. We've approved a number of regulations or bills. We thrive until we create consensus, but we are approving with concern. I'm sure the department, you are taking this very seriously. The committee whip is indicating the matter that one day will turn back to Pretoria. It happened before. It's not a story. It's not a joke. We did turn things back. Because we don't want to represent. Don't want to represent. Fortunately, this committee has got very serious members and very rich background and experience. Not just members who were got from the street somewhere who are politicians because they are voted for the inner house. You know, very credible members of this committee. They're very serious. So where we don't agree, we will do it. We're just giving a warning to say, please take this committee serious. Other issues, we will take them with the department separate from this meeting because there are issues, DDG. There are issues, serious issues, not only this one. In terms of that is why I had to give you the background of this committee. I've been dealing with 9 departments, not only this one, 9 departments. So we know how we work with all the departments who are raising it because there are issues. Okay, thank you very much.
from the department and the CISOs, we wish you well, but please, we don't want mistakes. We don't want mistakes. Go and implement with dignity that it deserves and know that you are representing all of us. We have put our hands here. We want to be represented well at a committee. We want to associate ourselves with you. We don't want to say, when they say CISO, they say, but each person can have a hand, just one minute, because AMA party week has to go to a multi-party meeting, which is starting any time from now. Just a second.
Jefferson, Honorable Jefferson, and Honorable Members. Just
your 1 minute, Sanchukunta. Just a
close meeting. I would like just to express a very heartfelt word of thanks for the way you have led us in this way. Secondly, to say from the board point of view, we are happy that with all the concerns, you have been able to give us the opportunity to move forward. Because otherwise, this organization would have not been able to move forward. And then it would have been an indictment on us, having got an act since 2011 and 2016. That act has not been enacted. Thirdly, to say we would really appreciate the opportunity to get those particular concerns. If it is possible, maybe rising out of the minutes of this meeting to attend to those concerns, because we would also not feel good as the board to have regulations that are approved with a number of concerns. I think some of those concerns, as the board, as we saw, we could try our best to respond to them, including those other specific things that you have mentioned, like the budget, like all of it. We would like to feel that we have the confidence of all our legislators that when we go to the community to implement this thing, we don't have a feeling that we don't get a full support. But it's sufficient for us to go home knowing that these regulations have been approved. However, we'd like to respond to those concerns. And so that we, when we come back to account tomorrow, we are coming knowing that we have given all the respect that the Chief Whip and you, Madam Chair, has said. So we want to express our thanks, and we would be willing to deal with those concerns and bring them back so that, because this is not the end of the situation. We still have a duty to come back and account as to how we are operationalizing. If any offense that has been made in any way from the board point of view, we want to express our heartfelt apology. We are not here to undermine anybody. I just wanted to make those comments. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. Chairperson, I'm sure your team was writing. Members did write their concerns. I wanted to ask if they were still going to send it to you. The team from your side was recording them down. If you can just respond on them, we'll take it from there.
Thank
you very much. The meeting is not adjourned. We're having a management meeting at 2. At 2. We're having a management meeting at 2. Thank you so much. I'm going to go to the next one.
I'm going to go to the next one.